Today we're going to talk about learning. We're going to talk about skill acquisition. We're going to talk about the four stages of learning, how they've been presented, and we're going to try to relate that to coaching cues.
You mean it's, how coaching it's not, is because it's not related at all?
Yeah, all of that and more today on this week's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
I love the lead-ins. Man. A
couple articles that Bill has written. We'll plug the network. So there's this place called the UHP Network, if you don't know, where it's the place to learn Bill's Unified Health and Performance Continuum Model. Lots of articles, lots of content. Courses are coming out. Go there, check it out. It's free, UHP.network. That's the web address. Mm-hmm. In the plus area, in the premium area, there's weekly articles, and Bill has had a series of articles about coaching, cueing, resistance training, how skill acquisition and learning happens, because it's been sort of vaguely described. And the things that people seem to talk about and use as the cornerstone for skill acquisition, especially when it comes to sort of the, either people call it the conscious competence model or the four stages of learning model.
Yeah.
It really isn't based in anything empirical, as far as I know.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is absolutely correct. In fact,
it's, let's talk about that. I'm gonna let you talk about it. So go ahead.
So the stages of competence. So this would be your in order: unconscious competence, unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, conscious competence, unconscious competence. Okay, yep. And this was started by a psychologist back in the 70s, and he had a company that did like leadership and communication training.
Yeah, it's the Gordon Training Institute, I believe.
Yes, it is.
The guy's name is Noel Birch. I did a little bit of research before we jumped on the episode.
So it's Gordon Thompson, right?
Yeah, it's his Gordon, learning.
Thomas Gordon.
These like corporate HR retreat things. It was one of those. Yeah. It was introduced at one of those, I believe, in the 70s.
Yes, very long time ago.
Yeah,
Very long time ago. Yeah. And it seems logical.
Well, it kind of sits next to the skill acquisition folks that talk about like autonomous learning versus conscious learning. It sort of parallels it in a way. There's enough of a carryover, I think, that people had just sort of combined them.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of a mistake.
Well, the whole thing is kind of gray.
Right.
Because it tells a really good story because it seems reasonable and logical. Right. The overarching problem, okay, is that it implies linearity. Yeah. That's the biggest problem that it has, I think. That you're actually going to go through these stages. And then the reality is like, okay, well, wait a minute. I'm dealing with a non-linear system. So humans are dynamical or complex adaptive systems, right? And so we don't follow linear paths at any time, really. And so right away we've got a problem, right? It just doesn't really describe, what we do. It doesn't, if you look at the stages of competence, okay, so here's the problem. It's linear. Okay, step one, that's a problem. It doesn't account for compensatory behaviors. It doesn't account for context. It's like in what context is this actually going to happen? It actually does not apply. And so it's easy to explain, right? And like I said, it sounds logical and reasonable. And so then it gets carried over into coaching. It gets carried over into like any number of realms have adopted this thing. But again, there's like, unfortunately, like perhaps observational. There's nothing that's like hardcore that says, oh, this is actually how it happens. And
right.
And, And I would argue that it doesn't really happen that way.
I think the big piece that you mentioned is lacking context. Because anything to be the most useful models are all going to be based on contextual things. Whatever you're dealing with. And so, and pairing off of that, the lack of any sort of feedback loop from using that type of model too. Because it's anytime you're in one of these stages, how are you testing and retesting where you're at, which stage you're in?
Thank you very much. That's a great point. Like I said, it feels good, right?
Well, yeah, it takes any of the discomfort out of the situation, because I know I got this little card in my back pocket that I'm like, okay, you are a type B.
You're now this.
Yeah, exactly.
And even the motor skill acquisition that's your cognitive, associative, and autonomous, right?
Yeah.
Even that implies linearity.
Right.
Right. It says, here's what you're going to do. And it doesn't account for the fact that you might just walk in the door, be asked to do something that you're totally unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. You could literally be automatic in that circumstance.
Yeah, you might just nail it.
This happens all the time.
I would think the person that can automatically do something autonomously or whatever, however you want to label it for the sake of this conversation, that person probably doesn't need to see you for a clinical reason. They're probably not coming in because they have a nagging injury.
Yeah.
Because they have the adaptability and the options to be able to do whatever.
Yeah. Right.
So let's talk a little more. We sort of introduced the concept and where it doesn't really have any sort of basis in anything and what some of the problems are with it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about now how the solution you're trying to offer, or the way that you've tried to start looking at that sort of quadrant type of representation of learning. Mm-hmm. And
can I jump in real quick?
Sure. Let's talk about the quadrants. I just want you to talk about the quadrants that you were using.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not learning.
Right.
This is not stages of learning. So let's just nix that whole idea. Right.
Okay.
What this is a recognition of behavior. We have to be able to recognize it as, oh, this is the behavior that I'm observing. So this whole baby step back to the incompetence thing. Okay. The implication here is that you don't know what you're doing. And I would argue that that's not the case. I think that every behavior that you are observing is a solution. Now, you may not have the adaptability, right? Or the awareness or the strategy to produce what would be considered the favorable, or lack of a better term, and I don't like to necessarily use this term, ideal. But you are solving the problem, which implies competence. It just might not be the desired outcome. And people say, well, it's just semantics. It's like, no, it's really not, because you are actually solving the problem. What you're observing is what behavior did I use to solve the problem, and is that the desired outcome in this context?
Right. Go ahead. You can keep going. Sorry.
Well, I just want to be very clear that this is I'm not making a comparison to those models of learning. I'm saying that people are demonstrating behaviors, recognizable behaviors, that will tell you how they are solving the problem, and then that gives us better information to design a more favorable task, to use strategic resistance, to apply the proper cues at the right time to produce what would be the desired outcome in a context.
Yeah. So in a lot of cases, I think people, the motor learning folks or the coaching intensive folks are going to think that they have a way to coach someone out of a strategy or movement behavior. And a lot of times you're dealing with a structural change or a structural archetype that you, that those are the cards that they've been dealt at this given right. moment, and they don't have right. any other options to how, as to how to move. So it won't matter.
These are defined by the constraints.
It won't matter how hard I tell you to squeeze your glutes or how hard I tell you to drive your big toe into the ground.
Right.
They are so far in one direction and twisted in a certain way that they are only going to be able to produce one result as they move.
Correct.
Okay. So that's
I actually have an example that happened today that we can go through before we wrap this. I can show you in real time. Like, this all happened within like 30 minutes. Like today. Nice.
So stick around for the later part of the episode for that. We'll get our retention numbers.
There's the highlight. It's coming.
Yeah. So we'll try to get to that. Let's step back a little bit. So we started the conversation talking about skill acquisition. We're going to talk about coaching cues a little bit. Bill actually has written two articles. And then one of the reasons I want to talk about this particularly today is that even over the course of the last couple of months where Bill is trying to create some solutions for this or problem solve this sort of coaching scenario, learning, skill acquisition type of thing, he's changed how he's presented it. So I kind of want to know, and this is great because a lot of times when people come up with a model or a theory or something to present, they just stick to it and they won't change it, even if they find out later that something better, there's some way better to expand. So let's go through that process. Like, you took these four sort of quadrants, you sort of made them make a little more sense coherently.
Yeah.
And then you changed them.
Yes.
Because you found out it wasn't as coherent as your first.
It wasn't thought. As so good as I thought it was. Absolutely.
Take me through that.
Well, I'm going to give a little bit of credit to Dave Snowden at Kinevin. Mm-hmm. If you've ever followed any of the Kinevin model, which is a problem solving model, and I talk about a guy that doesn't care if he has to change time. it's like he's a brilliant smart guy, and there was a category. That started out as simple and then obvious. And then I honestly can't remember what it is now, but it was really cool. It's really cool. It's like he says, it just didn't work. It's like, the more we get into this, the greater the depth that we gain in our problem solving model, he goes, this term works better. And I loved that. And that's literally like within a couple of months of application. It's like, this doesn't really work. And then it was like, okay, how do I get people to remember this? And then, so I started to use some alliteration and things like that to help people sort of remember it, remember the quadrants, because they started off as, here you go. It's like, there's purposeful and then compensatory performance and then automatic and unconscious. And it's like, okay, those were useful, but I think we did better. So I sort of modified them, like I said, used a little bit of alliteration so people can start to remember these things.
Yeah. Let's take step one. How did you get to those four first, the ones that you ended up changing? So let's get start there. Okay. And then.
Yeah. So there's two elements that you want to consider when it comes to coaching is how conscious is the effort? Like, what is the degree of effort that somebody is actually putting into a task? And then the second one is, how much control do they have? And so this would be sort of your measure of adaptability. So we have intention as one element, and then we have control as the other. And then if you make your little, like your little four square kind of a thing, so like, was it Eisenhower matrix kind of a thing, right? You start to say, okay, so I could have a high intention, a low intention, low control or high control. And so then that starts to formulate this quadrant concept and gives you some clarity. And to be very clear, these are not absolutes. Like, people aren't like only in one, but there might be like a predominance of one or the other, right? And because this change happens in real time. Like, this is not like a continuum. Like, we would talk about like health versus performance. This is literally somebody that is demonstrating this difference in behavior literally, like I said, I have an example where we just did this within session. And but it allows you to be a little bit more precise when you're trying to produce an outcome in the way that you communicate with an individual and the way that you organize a task and then the strategic application of directions and contacts and resistances and things like that. And so it allows you to organize the inputs that you're using, your strategic inputs. It allows you to organize those so you get the strategy produced that you're seeking as an outcome. So the intention versus control thing is where I think it is most useful. Like, I don't give a rat's patootie, to be honest with you, about the names. The names are helpful because they help you organize. But it's the understanding of intention and how much control somebody has over what you're asking them to do.
I think it's helpful to think about this from the perspective of you're given this sort of framework of these quadrants. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's a step by step thing. They don't just not fall close, into quadrant A or B, but right. it can give you some options in terms of like where the person I'm working with, where are they on this, in these quadrants, yes, around approximately where are they? And then what should my choices be, yes, when I'm in each place?
Yeah.
And that can, yeah, give you the right choices for, you know, cause you might have someone who has this sort of like high intention, like very low control. They're almost a danger to themselves moving around. That person, mm-hmm, might need to start without weights. That person might need to start closer to the ground. Uh-huh. That person might need to use very soft strategies for everything, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And again, there's the reason that I think the quadrant concept becomes useful is because it allows you to just make better decisions like at that moment. And again, because people are in this constant state of change. Let's use something that would be in the coaching awareness box, if you will, which would be like an internal versus an external cue, right? So if I give you something that's more outwardly directed, that would be the external cueing. If I give you something that's more internal, then that would be something that would be more like sensory. Right, like I'm trying to become aware of something internally, and so there would be times where an internal cue would be more ideal than the external, and this is reflected in the quadrant behavior as to what would be more favorable as far as producing the response. So if I have somebody that let's just say that, okay, you mentioned high intention, low control, right? Yeah. So this is somebody that, unstable. They have a very small window, as it were, as to how they can execute something. So you're asking them to do an exercise and it appears to be controlled, but the minute that they step outside of like this small window of adaptability, then they actually lose that control. And so under these circumstances, this is like, as far as how you would approach this with the internal versus an external cue, this has to become an internal cue, because if I direct it outwardly, then that actually becomes a destabilizing element, right? And so then it has to be again more of like an internal. So this might actually be a tactile cue that I would use in this circumstance versus directing someone's behavior out and away from them. So it would be like within their space, so to speak, that you're going to provide this cue, because again, if you direct it too far outside of their awareness, they cannot control this, right?
Right. So and, yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. I was thinking of like an example where you can kind of jump from. So originally you had talked about the high intention, low control people as being purposeful, and then you changed that language to something else.
Oh, wait, so this one actually stayed. This one stayed.
Okay.
This one actually stayed, because what I did is I used the P words for alliteration purposes.
Oh, okay. So is that really the reason why the words changed?
It's one of the reasons. Like I said, it was just too hard to remember the other names, and okay. so they became fewer. So this purposeful. So purposeful would be indicative of somebody that has a high level of cognitive effort involved in the activity, but a lower level of control. So they have a very small window within which they can behave. Outside of that, then they become poorly controlled and unstable, as it were.
Right. So yeah. I think a good example that comes to mind for a lot of people that I've worked with are those who keep hurting something. Say they keep throwing their low back out, or they know that they bend in a certain way, or they move in a certain way that it hurts their back in a certain area. They have a lot of intention, but they haven't really been coached or taught, so they have very little control over what they're doing. Right. They know that they have to stay rigid and sort of move like a robot in order to pick up something off the ground. Versus if I take that person and I do the opposite of what Bill had proposed, and I give them tons of external cues.
Yes.
I move them into this place of compensated performance, which I know you would change.
It becomes a threat to them when you give them the external cues. They say, I can't go over there. I need to stay within this space because I know I'm safe and I know I can execute that here.
And that's the low back pain patient who's told that they need to keep a neutral spine when they bend over to spit their toothpaste out in the sink at night. So they are constantly, because I've heard this before, like exactly yes. that.
No,
that
I'm, thing. I'm with you. I'm with you.
So they've gone from high intention, low control to high intention, high control, which is just a nightmare situation for a lot of people.
I hesitate to say worst case scenario.
It's the place.
It's the end.
But you're getting pushed to the end.
I'll show you why it's not like death, but it does create problems.
Yeah.
So in this circumstance, so let's take your purposeful, which is again your high intention, low control kind of an individual. What they need is to be led, right? So we would use a strategic resistance that would fall into the category of a leading resistance. So this is a leading resistance is a term that comes from PNF. And so this is you providing a cue. And like I said, in many cases, it's a tactile cue to lead them towards the desired behavior. And in doing so, they stay within the window that they feel safe in, and then are progressively moved out of it, right? And so again, so I have more internal cues, so more sensory driven cues, and then I would provide a resistance that would lead them to expand their movement options in that circumstance. So that, again, I could, like, if it's PNF and you're talking about upper extremity behaviors, I use a resistance that guides them. I use cues that say, do you feel? All right. And things like that. Because again, if you try to drive them too hard, too fast, it's like, okay, then as you stated, then you're going to go into a more protective behavior.
Yeah.
The protective quadrant then was previously compensatory performance. But I think protective is actually a better word for the simple reason that you just stated, where literally instead of expanding their adaptability, I am actually securing their lack of adaptability. And so in this circumstance, people become very, very rigid
in their behaviors. It's explained a lot of – it's termed guarding in a lot of circles, I believe. Is that in the literature?
I think it's just a representative behavior where it's an increase in muscle activity and restriction
right.
of movement. When you have somebody that's driven into this behavior, though, this is where you literally have to stop what you're doing when this is observed. There is no great benefit to pushing the system any harder in this case. This would be a scenario where the recapture of relative motion would become your highest priority in this circumstance, because you have essentially taken away all options. They do not have the capacity to reorganize their system. And so all you will see is this repetitive behavior. One of the ways that you can identify this is to use an asymmetrical load, because what would happen in this circumstance where we used a leading resistance for the purposeful folks to expand their variability, what we're trying to do with loading in somebody that we believe to be protective is we want to magnify that strategy so it's identifiable. So that person recognizes the fact that, oh, I'm actually creating a restriction in my movement because this movement has now exposed it. And again, this is one of the reasons why these are not progressive stages, is because this could show up at any time. Like if I use the wrong load at the wrong time with the wrong person, I drive them into this protective behavior. Right.
Or so it's not just too much volume. Yeah. Too much fatigue.
Yeah, yeah. Like fatigue. Yes. And so we use this. So we induce fatigue a lot in training. And it's like, that's why that's how I determine dosages. It's like, oh, I just drove you into a behavior that I didn't want you to demonstrate. And it's my fault because it was my choice. Right. And so again, this becomes important to understand and to be able to recognize. So we can actually use the task to help us determine, like, well, where's the threshold that this person can actually behave with adaptability? Right. And so again, that's why this is not learning. This is a behavior-based phenomenon.
Right. And there's a variety of ways to measure that. If anyone's trying to figure out, it's like, are they breathing or not? If they're holding their breath, they're done. If their heart rate doesn't recover, they're done.
Number one cue for you to recognize that somebody has drifted into the protective quadrant is the fact that they start to hold their breath.
Yeah,
because that means if I'm holding my breath, that means I've taken one of the most foundational representations of adaptability, and I said, nope, I'm not going to use that. Like that is about as foundational as can be. So when you start to get the breath out, now there are certain times, like if I'm driving a high force, like I got 200 kilograms on an athlete's back and they're squatting, do I expect to see breath out? Oh yeah, but that's also a circumstance where there should not be a lot of adaptability. I don't want a lot of undesired movement under that circumstance. So I'm intentionally inducing that in that circumstance. What we're talking about here is it's like I'm trying to promote adaptability within the system, and I did something that drove them too hard, and now they're in a protective behavior.
Yeah. I'm thinking about like the performance, the health and performance continuum, the model that you've developed, created. That you got to remember that like they're the injury and the performance are very close to one another on that sort of continuum, like right next to each other.
Literally on the same line going to
nose. So it's like, I don't, and people get this confused a lot. So if I have someone who's a world-class shot putter and they're going to throw the shot put a record distance, I actually just watched a video of Brock Lesnar's daughter. She's a total beast.
I've heard that she's quite good at the shot put. Yeah.
But she's just a spinning refrigerator out there. There's not a lot of variability going on. And she's She's launching that thing. But this is different than the back pain person that as soon as you go to massage their shoulder or have them like roll on a lacrosse ball, they go and they hold their breath.
That is correct.
And you know you're immediately in that protective area.
And so another important point that you just made is that we need to recognize like what our intentions are by creating whatever context it is. It's like, oh, if I'm intentionally trying to reduce the adaptability to promote a performance, that's a whole different world. But it's still a recognition of the same strategy.
Yeah. So I want to take 5 steps back because I think we've probably lost some people in the weeds, which happens. But so we have these 4 quadrants. We've talked about the purposeful, which is the high intention, low control quadrant.
Yes.
And we've talked about the protective, which is the high intention, high control. And those two things being like in this circular continuum right next to each other.
Yes.
Okay. The states in between would be the low intention, low control, and then the low intention, high control, which you've termed which again?
So the progressive quadrant would be low intention, low control. And this is somebody that never had an athletic. I'm going to use this as an example. This is not like, cause I had a very high level athlete that literally went through this today. If you can picture somebody that's never had any measure of athleticism, they don't have what I would term a movement vocabulary. Like they don't have the sensations that would be associated with having any awareness to how they move. Like if you've ever worked with somebody and let's just say that you gave them a cue to brace, right? Yeah. To stiffen up and you're making reference to the abdominal muscles, and you poke them, you poke them in the belly, and it's you know, rock hard because they're bracing, and you go, do you feel that? And they go, no.
Yeah.
I don't know what you mean. So these people, they literally have an exceptionally poor sense of movement and awareness from a sensory input standpoint. But this is a great opportunity because you have a system that is just dying to reorganize in this circumstance, but you could screw it up pretty bad by trying to move them too quickly into something else. In this circumstance, so this is going to be a situation where we're going to add constraints to limit the amount of inputs that they can be aware of at any one time. And so we would take gravity out of the equation. We would take upright out of the equation. I'm gonna increase the physical contact with their body to, number one, so I can constrain certain things from moving, so I can provide them a loaded sensation, and then I can limit the number of things that I want them to do in that circumstance. So instead of having this stand up complex movement, so like, let's just say I was having them do a split squat, which is a wide open propulsive activity. I'm gonna take them out of that scenario. I'm gonna put them in the purple room where I'm in an enclosed safe space, and I'm gonna give them a large measure of control by constraining them, and then provide a limited number of things to become aware of, and then gradually expand that.
Yeah. Right?
So that is the progressive quadrant. But like I said, it sounds terrible, right? Because they don't really have anything to work with. But it's arguably the biggest opportunity to teach the system how to reorganize itself and change its behavior.
Yeah, they're the folks I term those folks lost in space. They're the Will Robinsons of the world.
So when it comes to cueing these people, so it's like this is where internal cues become exceptionally useful, because what you're literally doing is you're teaching them what movement feels like. You are developing this movement vocabulary for them so that they can start to make the connections themselves.
Yeah.
That's the goal here. But you have to reduce, you literally have to reduce the level of challenge. You, like I said, you have to increase the number of constraints and then limit the number of inputs.
Right. Because they have no experience. They have no point of reference. They have no context to draw from.
Exactly.
They have no analogies to make. So you have to create all of those for them.
Correct.
And that's where, you know, using the ground is super useful there, because it's like, if I put you on the ground and I go, like, you feel your heels, do you feel your SI joints, do you feel your shoulder blades? So it starts to give them this awareness. Because I think, I don't know if you had said this, I think you had mentioned this, like, every one of these steps requires a certain degree of self-awareness that you're providing, or they're providing for themselves.
Yes.
Well,
we just categorize this as inputs. Right.
Right.
And again, it's like, think about this. For me to increase your awareness of something, I have to reduce the demand of awareness for everything else.
Right.
Right. And so, I always have to relate this to superheroes, right? It's like, okay, Daredevil loses his sight. And so his other senses become magnified, where he literally has radar under this circumstance.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Batman versus Superman. It's like, okay, so Batman tries to hit Superman with like the loud noise to try to interfere with his ability to do other things. Right. So again, this is intentional reduction of inputs via increased constraints. And then, like I said, then it's something that you can literally build. It's a huge opportunity.
Right. So we have the purposeful progressive was what we just went over.
Yes. And protective.
Right? Mm-hmm. And protective. What's the third?
Fourth.
The fourth. Yeah.
So we covered purposeful, protective, and progressive. Those are the three that we've talked about so far. The fourth one is productive. And this is like the best place to be. Like if you could live here, you would have the world's easiest life, because this is low intention. So the level of effort required is very low, but you demonstrate a massive amount of control. And so these are the folks that tend to be recognized as your best movers, in a context. We have to be very specific that this is all context dependent. From a coaching standpoint, it's the easiest work day of all time because all you got to do is shut up. Like, this is one of those, you know, I've talked about this in somewhere else where the best coaching day of my life was the day that I realized that I didn't have to say anything. Like, cause you always feel as a coach, like for me to have a job and to be purposeful and to, earn my keep, so to speak, it's like, I have to be interactive. I have to be doing things. It's like, if you're a great coach and you have an athlete that's in this productive quadrant, it's like, just shut up, because these are the people that move with great fluidity, and then they self-correct. They don't need the input from the coach. You want to say as little as possible in this circumstance, because anything else then disturbs what they're trying to accomplish. So you want to, you become the interference when you talk too much or cue too much or whatever. And so there's nothing wrong with being silent in the right circumstance.
Yeah, because you don't want to push someone into this sort of purposeful or protective.
Yeah, and this is where external cues are the gold standard, right? This is a circumstance where everything is externally directed because they're not thinking about themselves; they're thinking about the completion of the task. And this is where you would like love to keep people all the time. It's just really difficult to do so, right? It's like you take a high level golfer that has a repeatable golf swing that he's used for a long time and it's useful. And then he decides, it's like, you know, I could get better and I need to make a change. And then he is no longer in this productive stage. He will find that he's going to lead himself into one of the other quadrants by trying to make a change of something that has been in a situation where he hasn't had to think.
And now he's thinking. There's your Tiger Woods. Like, how do I get better from the unbelievable performance of my youth? Right. I'm going to get stronger. I'm going to bench press and I'm going to back squat lots of weight and I'm going to do all these crazy workouts. And then I'm going to lose options, and keep changing my swing, get back surgery.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We've talked about the four quadrants a bit. We're not painting the full detailed picture. That's better represented if you read the articles that are on the network. Yeah. So head over there and check those out. Hopefully we've painted a good enough picture for people to enjoy listening to this. But let's pay off the people that have stuck around. Let's talk about your athlete client went through all these stages.
So I was over at IFAS this morning and I was working with one of our pro basketball players, and he's got a little bit of a left-sided issue. He gets like this recurrent sense of calf strain and a midfoot, like a plantar side midfoot thingy. And he's done exceptionally well, but like I said, he's doing real well and he's back on the court and everything that we've done so far has been great, but he still has these nagging little things. And one of the indications that he gave me is like, hey, when I shoot my right-handed layup, I have to jump off of my left foot. He can tell that he doesn't have the explosiveness off of the left side. So we took an asymmetrical activity as the KPI. And so I had him go through an explosive cross connect step up. And as he's executing this, what happened is he started to magnify the strategy that he was actually using to create this late propulsive representation. So instead of having sufficient internal rotation initially and then having the reemergence of external rotation that we would normally see in this propulsive strategy, where if you think about like compressing a spring and then letting the energy go, like letting the spring recoil and you know, release the energy, what he was really good at was compressing the spring and then nothing. Right. And so what I had to do was I had him do the cross connect step up so he could identify what he was actually doing. And so what happens under this circumstance, because he didn't have the capacity to release the internal rotation and reemerge with the external rotation, he started to create a substitution for the external rotation. So he starts to roll to the outside edge of his foot. His entire left lower extremity starts to turn away from midline, and it starts to drag his center of gravity with it. Right. And so right away he says, that's what's happening. He goes, it feels the same as what I feel when I'm on the court. So right away I have a guy that's in the protective quadrant, right? So he's working really hard. He's literally trying to fix this thing. Right. And so he has to remain in this rigid state so he doesn't deviate and literally fall over to a side. So he's starting in this protective quadrant. Well, we move him around a little bit, and then we start to say, oh, well, guess what? You don't have the option to even access this late propulsive strategy. You're using a compensatory strategy. So we had to do a little foam rolly stuff. And then we had to do a hip lift variation to teach him how to access the internal rotation without compensation first. So this was internal cues. So he had to learn how to recapture his foot contacts. He had to understand like what it felt like to push straight down into the ground versus using a compensatory internal rotation. So this is all internal at this point. So we literally took him onto the ground. We took away upright and we limited the number of sensations. So now we put him in a progressive quadrant so we can actually recapture some of the elements that we know that he needs for performance, right? So from there, then we move him to the purposeful quadrant. And so we took him to just a regular high box step up to teach him how to push through the ground so he didn't overcompress himself into the ground. And again, using internal cues. So he had to make sure that he was able to capture the foot contact. So his tendency because of the ER substitution was to lose medial foot contact, right? So we reinforced that in a dynamic activity that allowed him to capture the effective IR. And then we progressed that to the explosive cross-connect step up, which is what we used as the initial key performance indicator to indicate what quadrant he was in. And then we progressively moved him into the external cue, which was the verticality that he needs to actually restore the capacity to access late propulsion. And so by run literally, and this all happened probably within 20, 25 minutes. Right. So, and it wasn't the fact that he had to go through like a progressive learning stage. It was like, well, what stage is he demonstrating? What stage do I need to take him into to be able to recapture the effective awareness? How can I constrain the more dynamic activity so he can reduce the level of effort, and then finished off with literally like, I just shut up. I just like, it took him like three sets of the explosive step up. And I initially cued like the first set to make sure he had the foot contacts. And then I just shut up and I just let him problem solve. And then by the time he was done with three sets, we had everything back that we needed. Yeah. So literally boom, 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 like all four quadrants. But it's like, you know, there'll be a situation where maybe he comes in, in like a protective situation. We don't need to take him to the ground. I just give him like an internal cue, or I would use like a, like you take like a leading resistance, an exercise band, and you kind of like pull the center of gravity in a certain direction so he can understand where he needs to be able to move into. And we could have skipped over maybe the progressive quadrant or something like that. It's like I don't want people to think that they need to go through all four. It just depends on context. It just so happened that we were going to talk about this today and I had this situation come up.
Yeah. And it's also just the recognition that everyone's not in the same starting point.
Not even close.
It could be representing any of these quadrants. Yeah. But if you know what the criteria are for each quadrant and you have someone in front of you, you can sort of approximate where they're at and then make some choices. It allows for more efficiency with your decision making. It allows for you getting to that safe to fail experiment a little bit quicker, a little more effectively.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we covered a lot of ground, but I think that's good. Let's talk about it's tough to come up with these questions at the end, but it's like because I think about these things, but then I can't remember if we talked about them. Did we ever talk about like soda? What were some of the sodas that you drank when you were younger that don't exist anymore that you wish still did?
Oh man,
I got a couple. Kickapoo, I can go first if you want me to.
Is Kickapoo Joy Juice still around?
I have no idea what you just said. Although
it was sort of like a poor man's Mountain Dew.
So Kickapoo is a Native American tribe that actually is in my gene pool. So I am like 1/34th Kickapoo or something like
that. There's a box to check, huh?
Yeah. So I should have done that. But yeah, anyways. So I don't know if do they make Jolt Cola anymore?
I remember Jolt. It was like the highest caffeine and highest sugar content.
Super caffeinated. I think they might, but it might be like a novelty thing now. Or another company bought the name.
With a warning label.
Yeah, it was crazy. It made me go nuts. The fact that I was drinking that when I was like 12 is probably bad. And then Crystal Pepsi was such
RC Cola? Is RC Cola still around?
RC Cola, I believe, is still around.
RC Cola is by far the best tasting cola that has ever been
made. It really does taste great.
It is by far, like, it's better than Coke. It's better than Pepsi. By far the best tasting cola.
There is for anyone from like the Atlanta, Georgia area, I know that there's a restaurant. I don't know if it's a chain restaurant or if it's a single one, but I think it's called the Varsity. And they always sell out of RC Cola. I think it's one of the colas that they have.
I totally understand.
Yeah, it really does taste good. I haven't had one in a long time. I don't know if they still exist. People can answer in the comments about that. If anyone's from Atlanta wants to tell me if I got that right or wrong, go ahead and do that in the comments. But yeah, post below about colas that you used to love that you can't get anymore. I'm trying to think if there's any other ones.
So you call them soda?
So I lived in a weird place in Western New York where if you go to Buffalo, everyone calls it pop.
Okay.
But if you, because it's a very Midwest thing-ish to call it pop.
Yeah. So I transitioned. So I was nine. I was nine when we moved back to Indiana. And so I grew up on, here you go. What kind of Coke do you want?
Yeah.
And there was only one type of Coke. Everything was a Coke.
What
kind of Coke do you want?
It's a South thing too. As soon as you get closer to Florida, there's a certain area of the country where everyone calls it Coke. There was the Buffalonians who called it pop around me. So in like the main grocery chain in New York that's now spread nationally, Wegmans, everything was pop when they originally came out.
We moved to Indiana and then it became pop. I had no idea what people were talking about.
So they have like they had their own brand. It was called like W Pop and it had all these different flavors. So I was like, I think I probably called it that for a little while too, just because Wegmans called it that. But then it's just their sodas, because it came from a soda fountain. There was soda a soda fountain. Jerk. Yeah. Like these people. So that made more sense to me.
How old are you? Soda Jerk.
I'm an old soul.
Is this the 60s?
I'm 40.
Go down to the drugstore and get your favorite, Red Phosphate.
Yeah, Red Phosphate or your what were they called? Malts. You get a malt.
Oh, yeah. Get a malt at the drugstore for a nickel.
All right. All right, this is going on too long. We'll end it here.
That's awesome.